Uploading. Tsunami Black Hole Megamix 2K3, now.
The fate of the whole world is in my hands.
You foolish man. I am Ajito Ryo Master. Allow me to reunite you with your ancestors.
Thomas Primetime Mattis, and this week on Tom's Prerogative, it is going to be a glorious show, because this week, you know, and kind of funny, it actually didn't plan it because of this, but it just happened to fall, because honestly, I don't give a damn about them, but it's kind of funny that the Oscars were this past Sunday, because today we are going to be reviewing the greatest movie never to win an Oscar for Best Picture. That was nominated for Best Picture. In fact, the movie I personally feel was screwed that year out of winning Best Picture. Again, that's my opinion. But as I said last week, it is the most perfect movie of all times, in my mind. And that is Walt Disney's Beauty and the Beast, as we finish out Disney Month here at the Absolution Network. It's Beauty and the Beast. It's a movie everybody loves, you know. It's one of those movies where I can be in a room surrounded by people of different faiths, different cultures, you know, different political differences, and yet we can all agree that this is a great movie. That's how good this movie is. Unfortunately, yet again, we do not have any emails or comments, and I'm still working on iTunes, and we are actually working on iTunes. I apologize. It's going to be funny to, when this finally gets on iTunes, and to have somebody give an iTunes review, and like, he talks too much about getting stuff on iTunes in the early episodes. But that's here nor there. But with that being said, we're going to get right into this, because I want to sort of get into the groove before I get caught up, like, oh my god, I've spent this much time talking about this. So, let's start off with cast, and mind you, here, when we do cast, we're going to also say, we're going to say the name of the actor or actress and the name of the animator along with the character itself. So, running down cast, we have Paige O'Hare playing Belle with an animation done by James Baxter and Mark Henn. James Baxter was the lead supervisor and Mark Henn was the lead supervisor in Florida. I think it was around the time they were starting to move the animation studio towards Florida. So that's why they had two different sort of leads in that situation. Robbie Benson plays the Beast, animated by the legendary Glenn Keane. Richard White plays Gaston, animated again by the legendary Andreas Deja. Jerry Orbach, the legendary Jerry Orbach, you know, who I'll talk sort of about his voice later on, because it is a thing to where I remember him most, actually from Law and Order and this film, and it's a weird thing to see, like, hear his voice here, and of course hear it in Law and Order. But Jerry Orbach plays Lumiere. Supervising artist is Nikki Ranier. David Ogden Steers plays Cogsworth, animated by Will Finn. Angelica Lansbury plays Mrs. Potts, and Bradley Michael Pierce plays Chip, and I say both of them because they're both animated by the same person, David Perukisama. Jesse Corti plays LeFou, animated by Chris Wall. And Rex Everhart plays Maurice, animated by Ruben Aquino. directed by Gary Trousdale and Kirk Wise, and produced by Don Hahn. Our story starts off following a young woman named Belle who lives in a little French village. It's sort of happy all the time, where she goes to, you know, pick up her books and do errands in town. Of course, in this town is Gaston, the Prince Charming of the village, who has his eyes set on Belle. Of course, Belle thinks he's absolutely disgusting. She lives with her father, a inventor who's always trying to invent things, which causes the town to think that, you know, he's insane in the membrane. Insane in the brain! I'm sorry, I couldn't help the Cypress Hill joke. But anyways, one day, Maurice gets lost in the forest as he heads towards a inventor's convention, and after getting chased by some wolves, finds himself at a dark, fog-heavy castle. He makes his way into the castle and is helped by strange things, you know, a candlestick, a clock that all seem to talk. He's later, though, captured by the master of the castle, just who's only known as the Beast, who accuses him of coming to try to stare at him and throws him in jail. Meanwhile, back at the house, Belle is surprised by Gaston, who's trying to quickly propose to her and throw her into a shotgun wedding. Of course, Belle sees through this and throws him out on his ass, leaving him embarrassed. After he's gone, she goes off to continue doing her chores, questioning if something good, something more that she wants will ever come to her life. As this is happening, Philip, her Maurice's horse, comes running back looking all scared. This leads Belle to have Philip lead her back to where her father got lost, which is the castle. Upon entering the castle, she somehow makes her way, with the help of Lumiere guiding the way, to the tower where she finds her father cold and starting to get sick. The Beast ambushes them, and in the process, Belle makes a deal to exchange herself for her father's freedom. The Beast agrees and quickly takes Maurice out before she can even say goodbye and throws him to a carriage to be taken to the village. Meanwhile, he gives Belle her own room, saying that she will come down to dinner. Back at the village, in Gaston's pub, Gaston is moping around because he's been rejected by Belle. But after some lifting up from Froth in song, you know, him and Froth formulate a plan after Maurice barges in saying that Belle is now locked up in a castle with a beast, and everybody thinks he's crazy. The plan being that they will have Maurice thrown into an insane asylum and blackmail Belle. Back at the castle, Belle refuses to come out of her room, not coming down to dinner as the Beast wanted, causing him to basically have a temper tantrum and stow him off to his room. Oh, the poor baby. Later on, Belle sneaks her way out towards the kitchen, and after a song and dance with dinner from Lumiere and all the castle staff, she goes on a tour with Cogsworth and Lumiere. During the tour, she manages to sneak away from them and head towards the West Wing, which she had been told is forbidden. As she makes her way through the West Wing, she comes upon the Beast flower, which early on in the film you're told through stained glasses at the beginning that it's his one guiding light and that it's basically the ticking clock to, if he can't find love and have somebody love him before the last petal falls, he'll remain a beast forever. Just when she's about to touch it, the Beast shows up and gets home and screams at her because of what she almost did, causing her to break her promise and leave the castle. As she tries to get away with Philip, she's surrounded by wolves, but is saved by the Beast. But the Beast collapses and they go back to the castle. Upon cleaning his wounds, the Beast and Belle have an understanding of each other. As this is going on back at the village, again, Gaston and Fro are talking to the head doctor of the insane asylum, and bribe him to throw Maurice in jail, or should I say an insane asylum, but arrive just minutes too late as Maurice, as I said just minutes ago, has just left to go get Belle himself. As all of that is going on, back at the castle, the Beast is starting to fall in love with Belle and starts doing things to try to win her affection. You know, giving her complete control of his library, you know, doing things with her, everything. And at the same time, Belle is starting to fall in love with the Beast, noting that there's something there that they hadn't seen before. Which, of course, gets the spirits of all the castle staff up because they think soon they might be human again. That's something that leads more towards the special edition, which we're actually not covering, but I'll cover it in a small little bit, but that's besides the point. Which, of course, leads to a wonderful ballroom scene, which is a signature moment of the movie. As Beast asks Belle if she's happy there, she requests the one thing she regrets is that she can't see her father. Upon hearing this, Beast gives her a magic mirror, which allows her to see her father. And they see that he's lost in the woods trying to get to the castle and is becoming sick and is dying. Seeing how sad this makes Belle and how much he loves her, Beast decides to release Belle from her captivity and set her free. Belle then runs off after thanking the Beast for all he's done and saves her father and takes him back to their house where he starts to, or where she starts to take care of him to help him recover his cold. But soon after arriving, Gaston arrives with the insane asylum bus and the people of the village to throw Maurice in the asylum. In a last-ditch hope, Belle grabs the magic mirror, which the Beast had given to her as a going-away present, and requests to show the Beast in a last-ditch effort to prove her father's innocence. And while it proves his innocence, it does sort of the opposite for Belle and Maurice, as in Gaston's jealousy, he takes the mirror and convinces the villagers that the Beast is dangerous and that they need to kill him. Though he wants to kill him more to, you know, eliminate his probably only obstacle in obtaining Belle's love. They throw Belle and Maurice in their cellar and lock it and go after the Beast. They make their way to the castle and try to break the door down, with only the castle staff trying to prevent the door from opening. Meanwhile, the Beast, saddened by the loss of Belle, doesn't do anything and just watches as his castle is being invaded. Chip, who had stowed away with Belle when she went to the village, manages to help free them from the cellar with the help of Maurice's inventions, and they make their way towards the castle. The village mob with Gaston manages to break into the castle, and yet is ambushed by the castle staff. As the villagers and the castle staff fight, Gaston makes his way to the top of the castle to try to look for the Beast. The castle staff is successful in forcing the village mob to retreat, but Gaston finds the Beast and starts fighting with him, first shooting an arrow at him and throwing him through a window. And at first, it seems like he gets the upper hand. And just as he's about to deliver the final blow to the Beast, Belle shows up and gives the Beast hope again and the strength to fight back. The fight scene continues and the Beast gets the upper hand and has Gaston dangling over a ledge. But because of how Belle has changed how the Beast has fell and think, he decides to give him one more chance and let him go, telling him, get out. Belle makes her way to a balcony and Beast goes up to her. And as they look deeply into each other's eyes, Gaston shoves a knife into the Beast's kidneys. But one swipe of the Beast's large arms sends Gaston flying off and falling to his death deep into the ravine below. We know he dies because he has skull and crossbones in his eyes as he falls to his death. The Beast manages to make his way onto the balcony and is dying in the arms of Belle. He remarks how I'm glad that he at least had one more time to see her before he died. And as he dies, Belle says, I love you. Just as the last petal of the rose falls. As the staff and Belle is crying over the Beast's body, all of a sudden the Beast rises up and light comes down from the heavens and the Beast changes back into human and is alive. And then him and Belle kiss and the castle changed because the spell has been broken. And Belle and the prince live happily ever after. The end. And it is such a wonderful movie. I have nothing witty to say. Not like I really have anything witty to say anyways, but that's besides the point. But with that, let's get right into the review of Beauty and the Beast. Dear as all that's done, started with our review of Beauty and the Beast. And again, as we usually do, we have music, animation, story. And let's get right into it with music. And first thing we're going to talk about is the overall score here with Alan Menken and Howard Ashman. Just an absolutely wonderful score. Mind you, this is not the last score. This is the last score completely done with Howard Ashman, because he partially started on the score for Aladdin, or at least the songs for Aladdin, mind you. I mean, Alan Menken did the score, the complete score, and Alan Menken was also for producing it and worked on the songs. He was, like, the lyricist. And that's something we'll talk about in a little bit, talk about his legacy, because Howard Ashman did die during this film. But I love the score, just a very sort of traditional orchestra score. There are just some, besides the song, there are some great moments. A lot of the score is sort of instrumental pieces of sort of the songs, which is wonderful. One of my favorite sort of non-song pieces is, I know it's in a place where Belle is shown her room and she flings herself on the bed and then sort of has that very sorrowful song, you know, da 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 da. I'm not going to attempt any chance here to try to hum it, but it's just this wonderful piece, and there's a lot of instrumental music that is just so wonderful in this movie, and it never feels like mood. You never feel like you're being used by the music, which is wonderful. It's just such a beauty to listen to, and I absolutely love the score. Traditional orchestra, as I said, nothing left out. And I really do suggest you listen to it just for the score. I mean, everybody focuses on the songs and everything like that, but the score is just as beautiful and should be listened to as well. But speaking about the songs, let's move on to the songs and, you know, how they move the story along. The first one we have is this operetta song called Belle. It's the, you know, the very first song. It's sort of the opening of the movie itself. And it's sort of operetta, you know, into the village. And you, one thing the song does that I love so well is how it brings you into the village. It brings you into this world. It invites you to be a part of this village and sort of this community that Belle is a part of, and introduces you to all the characters of the village. You know, because a lot of the people you see in this scene are people you'll see towards the end of the movie. And it's just this wonderful song about who Belle is, you know, and it sort of tells a story about what Belle sees in herself, and yet at the same time, what the village sees of Belle. You know, and what everybody sees is Belle. You know, she is this wonderful beauty, the most beautiful girl in the village, to be sure. And yet she's, you know, just not quite there. They think she's weird because, you know, she reads. And, you know, my gosh, what a horrible thing. A woman reading? Oh, God, what's this world coming to? But jokes aside, it's a beautiful song. You know, just the way it starts, you know. Little town in a tiny village. Da 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 da. Coming out to say bonjour, 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 bonjour. Just the way it starts is so beautiful, and Paige O'Hare does a wonderful job singing in this movie. And of course, you also have Richard Wright singing, and, you know, Gaston has a piece and everything, and it's just, it's a very well done opening, and just brings you directly into the movie, directly into the reality of the movie, mind you, and entrenches you directly into the movie's reality, which is an immediate good thing for the film. The next song we have is Gaston, and, you know, the funny thing I find about this song is this is, you know, usually the second song is sort of the, the Under the Sea or the, the Genie song. It's this very fun song, and that's what this is here. But in this case, it's the villain song. You have this very fun, upbeat, up-tempo song, and yet it's the villain song. And one of the things I like about it is if you actually look at it, it's sort of a paint-by-numbers scene to an extent, which in this case is not a bad thing. Because really, every word that's said, every lyric that's said, happens on screen. Maybe saying paint-by-numbers scene is not, because really that's not what to do, but you know, basically, they follow along with the song. Everything that happens in the song happens, you know. You know, when Fro is, you know, or Fro is talking about, you know, Gaston is the best and everyone else is drips, and he splashes and, you know, drips sing down. You know, when they're talking about wrestling, he's wrestling. When he's talking about chess, they're doing chess, and it's, they just do the scene that's said in the lyric. And it's just this fun romp, this sort of fun sort of bar song about how great Gaston is and how much the village loves Gaston. And it really brings you into the mindset of who this character is. He's the Prince Charming. He's the person in any other movie would end up with Belle and hook up with Belle and marry Belle. He's the bee's knees. He's the high school quarterback hero. Everybody loves him, and nobody can understand why Belle wouldn't want to be with him. Who wouldn't want to be with him? You know, he has money, he has charm, he has great looks. Everybody wants to be with him. And this song helps you understand that sort of village concept that sort of surrounds around him. And, you know, James Corden does a wonderful job singing it. And, you know, I just love the tunes of it. It's so wonderful. You know, no one looks like Gaston. No one thinks like Gaston. No one has a thin chin like Gaston. Da 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 We're actually kind of exposed that maybe Gaston's Jewish. I mean, with that much hair on his chest, he might be. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist the joke, but great use of lyrics. You know, Howard Ashman did a wonderful job with those. And like I said, it's just a overall fun villain song. And I actually think it's very underrated as a villain song, you know. You have the flashy villain songs like Ursula's and sort of Dr. Facilite's and sort of the other villain songs, but I think Gaston's is very much underappreciative. Part of the reason is, you know, it brings you into this idea of him not being a villain. It's a song to where, you know, he's the villain, but he's never sort of portrayed really as a villain until really the end. So, yeah, I really enjoy this song. Let's move on to our next song, which is Be Our Guest. Be our guest. Put our service to the test. Your napkin round your neck, shall we, and we provide the rest. Oh, this is such a fun song to watch. And I do want to add something. I didn't add the beginning, but some of my views in this review, you know, I do have the movie on Blu-ray, but a couple of weeks ago, I went and saw the movie in 3D, which I'll probably get into more on animation, but oh my god, it's a beauty to look at. And again, this is another one of those fun songs to where sort of the lyrics match exactly what's going on the screen. And sort of the concept of what this song really came out of was the idea that, you know, the castle staff had spent, you know, so many years trapped in these bodies with no one to serve other than the beast, that the first person that really came to their doors and was a part of, you know, their castle setting, they wanted to serve them so much, they basically went into song and dance and into serving them and, you know, put on a show for them. You know, an interesting thing is when Beauty and the Beast was first, you know, when all the storyboards were first being done and everything, they actually had Be Our Guest before Gaston. They had Beauty and the Guest being sung to Maurice when, you know, he comes into the castle. I can't remember who it is. You can listen to the story on the Beauty and the Beast Blu-ray. But basically, one of the story supervisors said, you know, I think we have the song in the wrong place. I think we need to move it back. And apparently he got a lot of things thrown at him because everyone knew he was right. And so they moved it back and had it with Belle. Because, you know, it works in both places. And I actually think it works better here. And I think, you know, it doesn't slow down the story because it did when it with Maurice. And it sort of brings Belle into this enchanted setting, which it does very well. But again, it also completes that idea that here's the castle staff, and they're so happy to have someone to serve that they're doing this song and dance number. Jerry Orbach does a wonderful job singing. You know, I think a lot of people, because they see him on Law & Order, don't know that he was really a song and dance man back in the day. You know, he could do all this stuff, and you know, his singing is absolutely wonderful here. I love the imagery that is put with the song. It's gorgeous. I love sort of the comedy in the song to where, you know, both Foe and sort of Cogsworth, it's sort of that, you want to laugh? Hit the, you know, it's one of the sort of things that came with this film, or at least one of the storyboard elements that, you know, they had in their film is, you know, whenever they came, well, we need a laugh. Hit Fro. Hit Fro in the head, beat him, tear him up, beat the hell out of him. And it was sort of the same thing with Cogsworth. Need a laugh, and you're in the castle, hit Cogsworth. So much stuff happens to Cogsworth. It's like OJ in the Naked Gun movies. Him and Fro. But we'll get to comedy later. So that definitely made the song enjoyable. And the tune is wonderful. It's this very familiar sort of song to where you know you've sort of heard this song before. You don't know where. You've heard the melody. Or at least it seems so familiar. And yet, there it is. It, you know, it's not. It's a completely sort of new theme. It's, very sort of Borghese operetta, you know, which is what they were sort of going for with this movie. Our next song is Something There. This is sort of a short sort of reprieve song. And it's sort of the song that tells you of this romance that's going on between the Beast and Belle. You know, actually it's one of my favorite stories in the creation of this song. I'll get to that in a second. But it's just this wonderful song. You know, you're something sweet and almost kind. That I didn't see before. You know, it's sort of this romance of, you know, them realizing, you know, they thought they knew what the what other was about. But now they realize that's not what they're about at all. And, you know, she's realizing that the Beast is kind of sweet and kind. And the Beast is realizing that Belle, he's not like any other woman. She's special. She's different. And that makes her even more beautiful, even more important to him. You know, he's starting to realize, I'm falling in love with this woman because of who she is. Not because of any beauty or smarts or anything like that. Because Belle is Belle. I'm in love with Belle. And they're starting to realize they're falling in love with each other. Of course, Belle isn't probably as quite as the same place as the Beast is. But you see in their relationship through this song, also how Belle is sort of changing the Beast. Changing sort of his greedy prince-like attitude, shall we say. Because, you know, he at the beginning of the film, he still sort of has that prince, you know, attitude about me, everything's about me. And through the film, you slowly see that change because of Belle. And this song does a great job of proving that. I love the ending of the song, how the sort of the last lines are said by the castle staff, because it then translates back into exactly what the castle staff is feeling as well. They're feeling there's something there, and of course the castle staff is feeling hope that there's something there because they want to be human again. And since I talked about human again, in this special edition there is a extra song sequence called Human Again. It's not in the original theatrical release. It was a song that was cut out because they thought it slows down the movie. They didn't know where to put it. And they ended up putting it in the play, but after seeing it in the Broadway play, they realized they could put it in the movie, and when the 2003 DVD limited edition came out, they basically put it into the movie, and so you had the original theatrical release and the extended edition, which they then, of course, also included on the Blu-ray release last year. Basically, the song is the castle staff cleaning the castle, getting ready for the, you know, basically the ballroom scene. You know, now that Belle and Beast are, you know, in this romance and being together, you know, they're cleaning the castle, you know, getting it cheerful, brightening it up. Because, you know, you do... That's one thing is throughout this movie... This is more animation, mind you. But you slowly see the castle seem to get brighter and brighter from, you know, its darker beginnings at the beginning of the movie. So, the castle staff cleaning it up. It's Lumiere, it's Cogsworth, it's Mrs. Potts, and, you know, they're cleaning everything. My overall opinion is that it may have felt right in the Broadway play, but no matter what, I think it just feels wrong in the movie itself. It does slow down the movie. And I think it should just stay in the Broadway play. I haven't seen it in the Broadway play. I don't see how it works in the Broadway play. So I would have to see the Broadway play to see how it works there. But I think in the movie, it doesn't work. Now, with that being said, if you do prefer the original theatrical release, you do have the option of just watching the original theatrical release. So I don't hold it too much against this movie because it's really an extra that's put on years later. And I really don't feel as important. But overall, the song, you know, it's... Again, it's not one of those familiar songs, you know, when we're human again, when we're human again. Da 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 da. When we're human again, when we're human again. Da 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 da. And it's sort of the comedic sort of... It's a comedic song that provides more comic relief between sort of the inanimate object castle staff. Now we move on to what is my favorite song in the movie. Probably is everybody's favorite song in the movie. I'd say that, you know, Pete aren't people that like Belle or Be Our Guest. But being the hopeless romantic that I am, I love, let me say this again, I love Beauty and the Beast. It is one of the most romantic songs I've ever heard of all time. This is my opinion. Yeah, it's so wonderful. The lyrics are perfect. You know, the lyrics, they're just so wonderful. You know, tale as old as time, true as it can be. Starting out as friends, then somebody bends unexpectedly. You know, and the rhyming of the song, it's all, the lyrics are beautiful from Howard Ashman. The melody from Macon is gorgeous. And of course, you know, the animation, the ballroom scene, one of my favorite shots in all of film is that, you know, and by the way, part of what adds to the beauty of it is before that shot, it shows the artwork on the ceiling. And you see the angels in the artwork moving and pointing at them, you know, as if, you know, this great romance is so great that even the angels on heaven are looking down at it, sort of the symbolism of this sort of great romantic tale. And, you know, then the shot, you know, I have two shots in all film that I absolutely love watching, just watching that shot. One of them is the sort of zoom in, sort of crane zooming shot in Sleeping Beauty when she's walking over the bridge. A lot of it because, hey, this is 1956, 58, and it's zooming towards Sleeping Beauty, goes under the bridge and towards the prince. For that to be done in animation is absolutely incredible. But this is the other one. The shot from the top, you come down, you almost through the chandelier, but to a side, towards Beauty and the Beast, and it's just one complete shot, this clean shot that comes down from the ceiling towards them, and then, of course, you know, Beast lifts sort of Belle over the camera, and they go off, and it is absolutely beautiful. I cannot talk enough about how gorgeous that shot is. And that whole scene from start to finish when they first come out those doors. Oh, God. It's everything I want in a romantic scene. I'm a hopeless romantic. I go goo-goo over this scene because I'm sorry. It's one of those few times where I'm sorry. As professional as I try to seem here, I can't not go fanboyish. It's like Gundam Wing. This is a scene I go fanboyish. Because I'm a hopeless romantic, and it is absolutely beautiful. It's everything I dream about in a great romantic scene. The entire story of their love is told. And you just see that they're perfect for each other. And then, of course, you know, the CG, you know, first true use of CG. Well, there's the stairs and Little Mermaid, but, like, Pixar being involved here. You know, Peter Nye, who's a director, who I think he did Monster, Inc. And Little Nemo, I think The Incredibles. I could be wrong, though, about that. But, you know, he was on the staff. He worked on doing that ballroom scene. The lyrics are beautiful. The song, you know, the great, like I said, the great melody. To me, they are, it's a melody from heaven itself. The lyrics just tell this grand, epic story of great romance. It is perfect. You know, it deserved its Oscar more than any other song that was nominated. And I think it's probably one of the greatest songs of all time. I have no problem saying that. I mean, I'm sure people can debate me, but that's my pick for one of the greatest songs of all time. Right there. You know, and to that extent, it sort of makes sense that there really isn't any other songs after that. There is one song, and that's our next song, Kill the Beast. It's a song, but it's sort of not a song. It is in that sense that it's sort of, it's a song that sort of moves the story from Belle's house to the castle where the fight's going to happen. You know, it's basically the song of Gaston convincing, you know, the village, you know, they need to kill the beast because of his jealousy. Not that he says because of their jealousy, but that, you know, the beast is dangerous and they have to kill him, even though the real reason he wants them destroyed is because, you know, it's obvious that the beast has captured Belle's heart. It's a great song. I love the lyrics into it. If there's one downside of the song, though, I kind of said it before, you know, it comes after probably one of the greatest songs ever made of all time. Yeah, and so, you know, there's really, it's that thing of, you know, once you reach the top of the mountain, there's really no place you can go other than down, unless you have a jetpack, but that's the point. But, you know, it's not to take away from, you know, this is a very good song, and it does exactly what it's supposed to. It moves the story to its important place. You know, and there's just some great lyrics from Richard White here, or at least from Howard Ashman, sung by Richard White. You know, I love sort of the Shakespearean line, I believe it's from Hamlet, where he goes, you know, screw your courage to the sticking post. Which, when that was originally put in there, the producer's like, wait, what? Are we saying something dirty here? It's like, no, it's a Shakespeare. I'm like, oh, okay, you can stay in. But, yeah, it does what it's supposed to, and it just, for all of these songs, they're beautiful. You know, the fact that three of these songs got nominated for Best Song at the Oscars, Belle, Be Our Guest, and Beauty and the Beast, with Beauty and the Beast winning, I believe, is absolutely incredible. You know, it just shows you just how great the film was just on music. And speaking of greatness, let's move on to our last point with music. The legacy of Howard Ashman. You know, I think Beauty and the Beast is a perfect representation of his legacy. Because, you know, he did songs for Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast. And he had started on a couple songs on Aladdin. In fact, one of the primary sort of influences for them doing Aladdin was in sort of, can't remember if it was Howard Ashman who came up with the idea. I think it was Ashman and Mencken who came up with the idea, but it also could have been John Musker and Ron Clements. But they actually had come up with the idea of the genie being this sort of shape-shifting, sort of Robin Williams sort of comedian, sort of jazz hostess genie. And so he came up with sort of the influence for that, and they had created some of the first songs. I believe they did Friend Like Me, definitely, and I think One Jump Ahead I think I could be wrong about that. But anyway, you know, Howard Aspin was very much responsible for the short time he was, he was there for a couple of years, but it was in his later years as he was dying. In fact, as they were finishing up on Beauty and the Beast, you know, and they were actually, you know, recording soundtrack and all that stuff, unfortunately, Howard was dying in New York and actually moved a lot of the production towards New York to make it easier on Howard. One of my favorites, it's become one of my favorite stories because I think it shows you sort of the showmanship and just really, you know, how much he cared about what he was doing. He was actually in his deathbed and they were doing the scene where they were singing Something There. And there's the part where Paige O'Hare sings, "Do and a bit alarming." And Howard heard something he didn't like, and so he picks up the phone, calls, and they connect with Paige, and he's in a whisper, and he goes, he's telling whoever's in charge of the recording, go, "Tell about new and a bit alarming. Tell Paige, think Streisand. New and a bit alarming." I just love that story, because I think it shows that even in, you know, being on his deathbed, you know, being as sick as he was, you know, he was still thinking about the film, thinking about the audience, thinking about putting this product, you know, I don't want to say product, but this masterpiece out there. Howard Aspin should be remembered as probably not only as one of the greatest talents in Hollywood and on Broadway, but unfortunately, the sadness that, you know, he left us so early. He left us far too early. I'm sure he had so much more to give us, and it's a sad loss that we couldn't see what he, you know. I think the fact is he lived a long life, and I think him and his family are very proud of his life. As a fan, I will personally be indebted for all that he's done for animation and for entertainment. You know, he's a man who created a little shop of horrors. You know, he's done so much, and it's a bit saddening that he's gone, but you know what, I think the best part for us to remember him is with these great films and just the great work he did on Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. They're just a showcase of his wonderful talent with lyrics and music. And I can't thank him and his family enough for everything that he's done for animation. And I know I'm talking about animation, but he really is one of the things that saved animation. And you gotta understand why I'm saying that. Music is a big part of entertainment, and especially of animation. And again, his music, his lyrics are a main piece to why those Disney films are so good. And, you know, it's those films that help set the pace back for animation being great in this country. So from my perspective, Howard Aspin is very much responsible for animation being, you know, becoming alive again in the 90s. And for American animation to get to the point it was in the 90s. I just want to take time to talk about that. But, you know, again, his music with Alan Menken, I don't think there will ever be a duo as better as Alan Menken and Howard Aspin. With that, we're going to take a quick break and have a word from a sponsor, but when we come back, we're going to move on to animation.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, a great adventure took place.
I'm going to regret this.
This is ridiculous.
Don't be alarmed. It's only a laser sword fight.
Star Tours announces the boarding of the Endor Express, non-stop star speeder service to the moon of Endor. All passengers, please prepare for immediate boarding.
No! Can I get your ship
out? Lando Calrissian is a positive role model in the realm of science fiction fans.
F*** Lando Calrissian.
Star Wars Monthly Mondays. Available the first Monday of every month at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
We would be honored if you would join us.
And welcome back. Now we move on to animation. Let's talk about the overall style first off. Again, especially because this is based in France, you do get a sort of sense of that impressionistic style, which we sort of also saw in The Princess and the Frog last week. But in this case, I think it was more of a... They're different, sort of same, similar style, but different. The French impressionist style in sort of New Orleans was more, I think, Americanized, where this is more sort of traditional. But, you know, smooth, sort of thin, crisp line work. Beautiful backgrounds. Just absolutely gorgeous use of watercolors and everything. And where I think it really works is, again, because it's fuzzy, it sort of brings you and entrenches you into this world through the art. It's absolutely beautiful. The color palette is wonderful. You know, for instance, there's a scene to where she's wearing pink, but it's sort of a darker pink, which I think works just perfectly. It's not this bright pink. Everything works towards this sort of world that starts off dark, becomes bright, and at the end seems to get dark again right before it becomes bright again. And sort of there's this great contrast in the art of darkness and light, which I very much enjoy. It's beautiful to look at. With that, let's move on to character designs, and let's start off with Belle, and oh my god, one of the most perfectly drawn female characters ever. My god, I love this character, because everything this character in looks absolutely gorgeous. You know, for me, the favorite part of her design is the eyes. Her eyes are perfect. They're these wonderful, inviting eyes that sort of tell you the story of this very sensual, well, not sensual, but when she wants to be, she can be sensual, but, you know, most this intelligent woman, but I say sensual. I probably shouldn't have started off about talking that, but I'm going towards the ballroom scene. There's a sensuality that you see in her eyes in that ballroom scene as she's looking at the Beast. You know, it's a very beautiful scene. It really helps this scene. We'll get to that later. But again, what I'm getting at is that you can tell her story and her emotion through her eyes. Just wonderful eyes. I love the fact that she's long hair. I think it was a great job for her to have long hair and for her to be a brunette. You know, I was actually talking with somebody the other day and kind of found it funny that my favorite characters in video games and animation, they're all brunettes. I just think it's the perfect blend of color between sort of the flashiness of red and the flashiness of blonde. Yeah, it's not the dullness of brown. It's that sort of perfect combination of a color. So I think that works very well. And, you know, James Baxter did a great job designing her along with Mark Henn. And the way they have her move, no wasted motion, you know, the way they, it's, you really get a sense of sort of independence from her character that is absolutely incredible. You completely believe in this character because of her movements. And when I say movement, you know, the sort of confidence that she walks, you know, when she's in the village and Gaston is trying to put the moves on her, it's like, Gaston, you're absolutely primeval. And sort of the way she looks at him is like, you ain't got a chance in hell. Why are you even trying? And of course, Gaston's like, duh, why? I'm pretty sure. We'll get to that in a second. But, you know, it's that, you know, the confidence that she carries, you know, as opposed to, let's put it to another Belle. Bella in Twilight, who when you, you know, this is a live-action actor, and when you see her in that movie, there's no confidence whatsoever. And, you know, she doesn't do anything in her movements and her acting of her body to make you believe in her. Here, you have a character that the confidence that she carries within her design and her movements makes you fully believe in her character. Let's move on to the Beast, and we'll talk about the Prince design at the end, but I love the design of the Beast. Glenn Keane did an absolutely great job. I think this is Glenn Keane's best design of all time, is the Beast. The different animals he brought together, the ox, the bear, lion, which is all theirs, wolf hind legs. In fact, he even brought a baboon in, and the fact that it's actually funny, one of the stories that came out, Yahoo did this sort of pictorial where it talked about facts about Beauty and the Beast you may have not known, and one of them was that Glenn Keane said that, the Beast has a baboon butt. In other words, that rainbow-colored butt that baboons have. Yeah, he has a baboon butt. But the only person who's ever seen his baboon butt is Belle. You know, it's times like that that I love animators, because whether he... I don't think it was his intention, but one could say, well, how has she seen his butt? Other than if they were doing something that's really not Disney at all. I mean, there's really no other way to sort of think about that other than sort of that way. I mean, in what context of the story would she have seen his butt? Especially if apparently she's the only one who's seen his butt. It brings up questions, you know. I'm like, think about that for a second. What were they doing that would have caused Belle to see his butt? Now, if there is a scene that's completely innocent that makes sense, please tell me. I didn't see it. But if there is, you know what? I'm fully with it. It's my dirty mind. But, yeah, I love the design of the Beast. Just this presence about him. And yet the way Glenn Keane is able to make the Beast feel emotionally or vulnerable. But just the way he's able to do that and, you know, show this great sort of emotion of kindness through this Beast, through this sort of, you know, this beastly character. It's absolutely wonderful. Like I said, strong, great presence from the character design and the way he moves. Love sort of the color schemes upon him. I think the blues and the purples work perfectly for him. The dark colors work, I think, best with the darker colors of the Beast and perfectly accentuate his good features. So I absolutely enjoy that. And since we're on the topic of colors, one thing I kind of forgot to talk about with Belle, and I apologize that I'm going backwards here to talk about that, is I love the color scheme of the outfits of Belle. I love her sort of blue and white, traditional clothing there. But she also looks good in the dresses. Of course, my favorite is that golden yellow ballroom dress. It is absolutely gorgeous. If there's any time, there are very few times, mind you, where you feel like you want to be the main character. And it brings you into an emotional status of wanting to be the main character. One of them is when you first see Jessica Rabbit. But the other one, I think, is Belle. You know, such beauty is before you. You're like, wow, you either are cheering for the Beast to get the girl or something. Man, I'm kind of jealous of the Beast. I wish I was the Beast. You know, it gives you an emotional attachment through everything that's built up, and then to see such beauty. Again, it just sort of completes that circle of, wow, you understand why the Beast is in love with her on so many reasons. Not just the sort of physical attraction, but the physical attractive part is there along with the other parts. But moving back to the Beast, really the last thing of the Beast is his Prince form. Now, a lot of people have said that they don't like the Prince form. And with that being said, I do understand what the Disney creator said when they believed that no matter what they would have done with the Prince, you know, nobody would have liked it because he spent the entire movie, you know, falling in love with the Beast. And I absolutely agree it. You know, which, again, movement to design, it makes you fall in love with the Beast, care about the Beast. I don't know what it is from a female point of view, so I can't, but hopefully I mentioned the females start to fall in love with the Beast along with Belle. So I do absolutely agree that you do spend all this time falling in love with the Beast. And so, to an extent, no matter what they would have done, people would have had a problem with it. That being said, I actually have no problem with the design of the prince. I mean, really the only one I can think of is Philip from Sleeping Beauty, but he may not even been it too, but really, who are the other blonde princes in Disney films? I really can't think of. I know he's maybe more of a brunette, but he's a brunette blonde, but I don't have a problem with it. You know, he seems princely. I think the thing I like about him is that there is a vulnerability of him that you see in the face. And the reason I like it is I get the feeling that, you know, I feel like that could be me. I mean, obviously not me, but I mean, he feels like somebody I could be. You know, he feels, even though he's this prince, he feels like somebody I could be or somebody I know. You know, there's a familiarity there. And I think that's because of the eyes. Again, we're talking about the eyes and the Beast. You know, the eyes are windows into these characters, which is a common theme, sort of the windows into the soul and who people really are. We'll get to that later on. But yeah, I actually enjoy the prince's design. With that, let's move on to our next character. Let's move on to Gaston. Again, Gaston, really the basic way to put it, Andreas Deja did a wonderful job portraying this. The high school quarterback, the superstar quarterback that everybody wants to be with, who gets the head cheerleader, everybody loves it, everybody thinks is the bee's knees. You know, sort of the confidence that he carries, the way he's jealous when he doesn't get his way, everything, you know, it's just such a great villain character because it's the complete opposite of everything we think of normally when we think of a villain. And Andreas Deja did a wonderful job on his design. Of course, you also had Ron Husband, who also helped out, among others. And, you know, the cleft in the chin, you know, everything, you know, this, he is everything sort of women fantasize about. And that he is that, and it's such a wonderful design. The color scheme is perfect. I love how sort of the bright red sort of complements his sort of cocky attitude that he has. And another thing is I love how Andreas Deja's, you know, he's sort of more wild, gets more and more wild as the film goes on. The more he doesn't get his way, the more his hair sort of gets out of line and the more wild he looks. And I enjoy that part of it. You know, and again, wonderful eyes. The eyes are just such great looks into who the character is. You tell just how simple and really just sort of how egomaniacal this character really is. Because really, that's what it is. It's about his ego. He's the best person in the village. He should have all of the great things, which includes Belle. You know, he looks at Belle as just another object, but we'll get more into that later. But yeah, again, eyes are a wonderful view into that, and again, wonderful, wonderful eyes. As we go into our next characters, you know, really, that's, again, like I said, it's a common theme. The eyes on all these characters are wonderful. The facial movements, they make you so familiar, because the next characters are Luminaire, Cogsworth, and Mrs. Potts. The facial movements and the eyes, they give you familiarity. So when they turn human, you know, they seem familiar, you know. You kind of see their human form before you see their human form. Wonderful work. Let me just go up real quick. You know, from Nikki Rainier, Will Finn, who would, of course, Will Finn would go on to do Iago the Parrot, and David Pariskma, who did Mrs. Potts. Of course, he did Chip. You know, they're just drawing these internet objects. You know, they're drawing a candle holder, a clock, and a teapot. And for David Pertama's sake, also a little teacup. And yet there's so much emotion thrown into these objects. You, like I said, you can see their human forms, but just, you know, I really think that animators should watch this film and see how the animators draw those characters, because it is so wonderful to see the amount of emotion through just the facial and, you know, eye movements that they portray through these characters. You know, especially considering that they're doing a lot of comedy slapstick with these characters as well. So it just, it adds to such a wonderful job by the animators in drawing these characters. They're absolutely perfect. And it leads to sometimes in this, you know, if it wasn't for the great romance, I mean, if this had been Little Mermaid or Princess the Frog or Lion King or anything other, I think these characters would have stolen the movie. But because you have such strong main characters and a strong villain, you know, it allows these characters to really be a great complement to those characters through their design and through their, you know, movements and their actions. So that's wonderful to see. Final characters we're going to talk about is the townspeople. We're going to talk about Maurice and Fro. Fo, which is, or Fu. I never know how to say his name. I always say this. I'm horrible with American. What makes you think I'm going to be best with other language? Or should I say be better? Because be best is not a word. But what do you think I'm going to be better saying names and stuff from other languages? That's here or there. But Fu, which is Gaston's little sidekick, you know, this sort of a goofy design. I think it works perfectly for the comedy slapstick that they do with him. You know, I love that about him. Maurice, you know, he has a vulnerability about him that I absolutely enjoy. Again, he's used for a lot of comedy, but it's not sort of the same with Fu, where, you know, you sort of enjoy seeing him get hit a lot. Here, it's sort of a, like, the wacky inventor type of thing. And then, of course, the town people. All these great use of facial movements, great use of eyes. They really bring you into who these people are. It entrenches you into the idea of who these villagers are. So I very much enjoy that. Let's move on to talk about special effects. I love the special effects. Again, a wonderful, wonderful job in special effects. The reflections, the lightning effects, the rain effects, even the bats, even though they're, you know, if there's one sort of thing here, it is actually about the special effects, because there are some special effects and things that are kind of missed. They're so minute, and they happen so quick that you, most people, in fact, a lot of people actually miss them. You actually have to slow down the movie to see it. But, like, one is, there's a scene where Maurice, you know, bumps back to the tree and bats fly out. And if you watch, the bats slowly disappear. What's creative about it is that the way they do it, it seems as if the bats just fly off. But really, if you look closely, they're just flying around and all of a sudden disappear. But it seems as if they fly off. And that's what happens with a lot of sort of these small, little minor special effect mistakes that happen within special effects. You know, but I still have to count, you know, they are mistakes. That's like, these are really minute things, because you really can't catch them unless you slow down the movie. It's things like, there's a scene where Philip just seems a bit too still for my taste. But it happens so quickly. It's the scene where they get to the gate and Belle sees her father's hat. Which, by the way, how does that hat get back there? Again, this is more story elements. But I'll go now because I really want to focus more on the good part of the story. There's like minute parts within, you know, how did a hat get back there? How long has Fo been standing in the snowman waiting for them to return home? You know, but they're very minute, and I really don't give them much thought, you know, because you're so entrenched in the main story. But yeah, that's really one of the few places that I can see sort of criticism is in the special effects, because there's a few special effects that got a little bit messed up. But they, again, like I said, they happen so quick. But other than that, the special effects are good. One of my favorite is the green lightning. I think it adds such ambulance to that final scene with the green lightning. It's a wonderful way to show how special effects can really add to a movie. And last but not least, let's talk about the backgrounds. I love these backgrounds. The impressionist style, sort of the watercolors, watercolor impressionist style is absolutely incredible to look at. I love looking at the backgrounds. One of my favorites at the end of the movie where the beast has Gaston by the neck and he's got him over the castle and he's begging for his life. And you look into the background, you can see the village and everything, and it's so inviting. I mean, yeah, you're in a deep, dark forest, but you feel, again, you can feel you can go into that forest and travel through that forest. You feel you can go down from that balcony on that castle that I was just talking about, cross the bridge, and go across the countryside. You feel like you're in a place. It entrenches you into this real-world place, into this reality. You know, this is background art at its perfection. It is absolutely beautiful to look at. Whether it be the castle grounds, the castle itself, the gothic and sort of baroque. that's another mistake, but we'll talk about that when we get to comedy. But the baroque and sort of gothic art styles of the castle itself and the detail, the attention to detail is absolutely beautiful. You know, which I didn't talk about that much when I was talking about overall style, because it is mostly impressionistic, but at the same time, you also have those gothic and baroque styles within the castle that are absolutely gorgeous. And then you also sort of have a Renaissance style, because you have that beginning when, you know, the beast, when they're all transformed, but when the spell is broken, you have the sort of Renaissance style that appears of the castle and of everything. You know, the stained glass window art is absolutely gorgeous. I didn't talk about that in overall style, and I apologize. That's something that really adds something unique and is a, I think, a staple of the film, is that stained glass window art, which is absolutely beautiful to look at. I mean, the telling of the beginning of the story in the stained glass art style is absolutely gorgeous. You understand the story completely, and it's sort of, it has a grandeur and epicness of it. But yeah, I love, 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 love the backgrounds. Absolutely perfection. With that, that's it for animation. So let's move on to story, which we will after a word from our sponsors.
Hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986.
And Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from crisis to crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
And welcome back, and let's move on to story. Again, let's talk about the overall theme, as we usually first do in talking about story, about the movie. And I think when it comes down to it, the overall thing, first of all, it's just a classic romance, first and foremost. I think that's actually the bigger story. It is that classic romance. It's the tale as old as time. It is the great romantic tale of Beauty and the Beast, of, the opposite to fall in love. You know, and for the most part, that's what the story is about. It's these two people who are opposites. This beauty, this strong, independent beauty, and this beast who, made mistakes and is trying to, find salvation, and them falling in love and their love breaking the curse. That's, I think, the overall main theme. But you also have sort of a similar theme because of that, of the, with the eyes being a window to the soul, and this overall, people looking at people beyond what you just see on the outside. People being more than what they are on the inside. People being what they make of themselves, I think, is another theme that is more subtextual deep into the movie. But again, I think the main one is the sort of the classic romance. And I like that it's this really simple, romantic, opposites attract romantic story. I like that. I always preach it. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity when it comes to story. You can have a lot of detail and sort of twists and turns, but as long as you keep the story, the main basic story simple, you could do so many wonderful things. I know going back to last week, I sort of talked about Princess and the Frog. There are those twists and turns in there, but again, they do still keep the story simple. It's a simple adventure. They got to find a way to break the curse. Simple. Not as simple as this, and I think that's why this movie works so well. It is so simple. They never get away from the main story thread, which is the Beast and Belle falling in love. They add these twists and turns. They add Gaston trying to kill the Beast because he's jealous and wants to marry Belle. They, add the sort of comedy bits, which are breathers, but for the most part, relaxes you from the main story as well. But they never leave what the main story is, this romance between the Belle and Beast. They're always focused on that main story, and they keep it simple, and it's absolutely worked to the perfection. And being that the overall theme is the romantic story between Belle and Beast, let's talk about the romance between Belle and Beast. Look, guys, I am a hopeless romantic. I actually didn't talk about this. I wanted to talk about this during music, but I sort of forgot to talk about it. I am a hopeless romantic through and through. I mean, to such a point that I actually have my wedding planned out. I kid you not. Yeah, take away my man card. I don't give a damn. I've actually had what I want to do for my wedding planned out since I was 14. I can't believe I'm admitting this on a podcast, but what the hell? I actually have my wedding planned out. It's going to take place in this forest of cherry blossom trees, the beautiful pink complement, which are the earthy tones. The bride will have sort of a pure white dress, and it will be down this row, and at the end of the row is this sort of like small little pond with an island in the middle of it, and like a single cherry blossom tree and a bridge towards the island, and I am at the entrance of it, and bride comes down, the father hands me the bride, and we walk over the bridge to sort of metaphorically walk over the bridge to our own journey together, take our vows. And the two songs that I've always dreamed that would be our wedding songs, to whoever my lucky bride might be one day, if I do have one, would be All For One's I Can Love You Like That and Beauty and the Beast. That's how much of a hopeless romantic I am. So, like I said, I love the romance in Beauty and the Beast. It just makes me squeal with joy. And I can't help but not be fanboyish. But what makes this romance work so well is the absolute building of it. This is the best part. There's this very natural, very organic build of this romance through this movie. You know, they hate each other at first. And, you know, while Belle is interested about the castle because, you know, she's finally in a place to where, you know, she can, you know, as we'll talk about in a little bit, you know, sort of find herself, you know, you have the Beast just jerk. More than, he's an asshole. Let's be, at the beginning, he's an absolute, absolute asshole. You know, he can't control his temper. He can't control himself when, you know, doesn't get anything he wants or doesn't get what he wants. Everything's about him. And, you know, they hate each other in court. But then you have that great scene where, you know, she's running away. And yet, even though the Beast is mad at her because of what she almost did, you know, how it almost destroyed things, you know, he still goes out and say, puts her his life in line and almost costs him his life to save her. And it starts to make her think twice about what she thinks of him. And that great scene, it's one of the best scenes in the movie where they're sitting down and she's tending to his wounds. Of course, the castle staff is there and they're worried. And when he screams, they go, they hide. But the fact that she's the first person to sort of stand up to his temper tantrums, to stand up to sort of his greediness, and it really changes him. You know, it's almost sort of that thing of what we saw in The Princess and the Frog, to where what Naveen needed was a woman to complete him. That's what the prince, the Beast here, needed was somebody to complete him. And that was Belle, because Belle, this smart, intelligent woman who wasn't afraid of him and allowed him to open himself up to her. And that's what you see happen. You see him open himself up to her and see his kindness deep inside. You see Belle open up to him, and just the way it builds, you know, from down playing in the snow and throwing snowballs at each other, and of course the great ballroom scene. You could tell everything about the story, again, their eyes, in the eyes, the way that they look each other. You see how much these two people love each other through the look of their eyes. It is absolutely gorgeous to watch. And then you should have that great dying scene where the Beast is dying in her arms, and it's that final realization. He's the first one to come to the realization that I'm in absolute love with her and I need her in my life. And that's why he sets her free, because I love her so much that I just want her to be happy. It's not something that is about just physical attraction. It's not something about internal, internal attractiveness. And when I say internal attractiveness, being smart and intelligent, independent, and all that stuff. You know, all those things are important, but it's that ultimate feeling, sort of that, you know, what love really is, this grand feeling that can't be explored just in physical attraction or in mental attraction or spiritual attraction. It's just this uncontrolling, undeniable feeling that just hits you. And you see it here, and you see it within yourself in the things that they do. It's a feeling that makes you do absolutely anything for that person. And the fact that he sets her free, and then at that dying scene where Belle realizes just how much the Beast means and, you know, says the words that ends up breaking the spell just in time, which, that is something great that the story did, how it builds the tension. That whole fight scene and the building of tension towards the breaking of the spell and the showing of how they broke the spell, that great transformation scene, you know, it's so wonderful. And that kiss, I think, is one of the best kisses ever in films. There are a lot of great, there's the Casablanca kiss, you know, it's right up there with the kiss from Casablanca and all of the other great kisses in film history. You know, I mean, look at it this way. It literally changed the castle. Literally. So yeah, I love the romance between the Belle and Beast. Let's move on to talk about Belle herself, because Belle is such a unique character in the fact that, you know, she is this strong, independent female character, you know, in the fact that she is in this time period where, you know, people look down upon a woman being so independent, you know, thinking and all that stuff. It's really wonderful to see such a well-thought-out and well-designed character in that mindset, in the way she takes care of herself. I mean, she can take care of herself. Before the Beast comes there to help with the wolves, I mean, the wolves do eventually surround her, but, you know, she, for a little bit there, is holding her own against the wolves. You know, a normal sort of ditzy princess female character would have just run wildly, but she led Philip towards an ice patch that got rid of a couple of wolves. She was able to fight off a couple of wolves with a branch stick. So she showed some ineptitude in being to hold her own. She was just outnumbered. You know, and the fact that she stands up to the Beast, even though he's this big, you know, menacing presence, but she's still able to hold her own. There's one thing I do want to talk about here, and that is, again, I'm going to quote Doug Walker, aka the Nostalgia Critic's Disney Semper, because when he talked about this, he talked about people's criticism of Belle being that she's not really independent, but she's sort of a spirit, if I'm remembering it right, of what we think is independence. And I kind of disagree with that. Belle is just herself, you know. You see exactly who she is in the movie. She has nothing to hide, you know. And again, it's what she wants is this spiritual need, not necessarily of just adventure, but of feeling important. Not even feeling important in the world, but, you know, knowing that you're meant for something grander, knowing that there's something more than this tiny little village, wanting to do something grand, wanting to feel alive. It's this spiritual need that she's looking for that is accomplished through this romance with the Beast. There's such depth to her character. You know, the way she's able to hold her own, hold herself, stand up to the Beast, hold her own against the wolves, you know, the way she stands up to the village and the way that the village tries to sort of, you know, mold. They want her to conform to their societal feelings about what she should be, where her place is. And she won't conform to that. There's a lot of things that she does do that really define her as such a strong, independent character. It's just a beauty to see. With that, let's move on to something a little bit less serious. Let's talk about the comedy. I love the comedy in the story, because the comedy in this movie, mind you, is absolutely incredible. My two favorite jokes come from Cogsworth. One of which, actually, David Ogden-Steggers screwed up. That joke being, when they're exploring the castle, he goes, if it's not Baroque, don't fix it. Which is not the joke. The joke is, if it's Baroque, don't fix it. In that case, he's talking about the Baroque art style, which is a beautiful art style to look. But that's an artist joke there, and it's a corny artist joke. And people always groan when you, like, hear that, if they know, especially if they know what the art style is. But I just love that. I love corny jokes. And so I love that sort of, you know, if it's broke, don't fix it. And then, of course, you have what I think is the best joke in the movie, which is when Beast says, I want to do something for her. And Cogsworth goes, well, there's candy, flowers, promises you don't intend to keep. Which, I want to talk about that for a moment, because, again, it goes right into sort of the beauty of these films is how they're for everyone. And they're not for everyone because they're for kids. They're for everyone because there's something in the movie there for everyone. There's mature subjects that mature adults can understand that children might not. And at the same time, there's a basic story that's told at the surface that children can understand and get into. You know, little girls can get into sort of the fairy tale aspect of it. The boys can get into the adventure, and more importantly, sort of the that beautiful princess and being the prince that saves the day. In this case, with the prince being looking maybe more like them. So there's that. But then you have the adult things. This is the perfect example of that. As a child, I laughed at that joke, you know, just naturally because it seemed like a funny line to say. But as an adult, you get sort of the undertones of that joke, you know, candy, flowers, promises you don't intend to keep. You get the sort of more mature underlying tones of that joke. And it's a wonderful joke. And just the slapstick comedy, whether it be with Maurice or Faux or Moulinaire and Cogsworth, just their constant bickering, which happens all the way to the beginning, the end, excuse me. It reminds me a lot of sort of Meriwether and Fauna in Sleeping Beauty, actually. Which they take the fair Sleeping Beauty ending dancing at the end. They're not ripping off. They're just being influenced by it. Which translates into they used it to save on time. But, you know, just all the times folk gets hit and knocked out, get the hell beat out of them. Another great funny scene is where at the beginning where Maurice is working on his invention. And remember I told you last week, John Musker and Ron Clements sort of idea of the three things of comedy is the funny face, drop your pants, and hit the guy in the head. And you have all three there. He pops out from under the invention. He has the funny glasses that cause the funny face. No, actually, the scene starts off with, you know, he has the barrel. He has to drop his pants, and you see the heart boxers. Then you see the funny face. Then they try to get the invention to work, and he gets hit in the head with a log. You get all three of those in the scene, and they're all great. I love the comedy. And the comedy does a great job of sort of giving you these subtle breathers from the main story. When they shift the focus to the village to go over Gaston's plan, or when they're going to what, you know, the castle staff is doing, and they provide comedy, it gives you a breather from that main story. You know, if they had just stayed focused completely on the story, you know, all the time, it may have gotten tiresome. But you're given these little breathers that really help in just complementing and completing the romantic part of the story and the overall theme of the story, which worked very well. And speaking of Gaston motives, I had to go over them. Because I think it does have a sort of deeper philosophical, textual connection to our society. Again, let me emphasize this. This is not something to where, oh, the Disney animators planned this deep in the film, but I think this is sort of a contextual thing that, you know, one could take from the movie that me personally actually gave me more enjoyment. Gaston motives is something that's very similar with today's society. We do try to conform a lot of people, you know. If there's one thing to say, you know, Beast and Belle represent the better part of our society, where Gaston and the village represent sort of the bad of our society. Gaston and the village, they represent, you know, how our society tries to force people to conform to societorial beliefs, even though they're stupid. You know, it's that thing to where we'll believe in somebody, even though what they're saying may be offensive and stupid, but because they're conformed to societorial beliefs, you know, we'll follow them. You know, it's, I don't want to get political here, but it's very much like current political situations to where we have presidential candidates that are saying stuff that we know is completely wrong and very offensive and out there strange, and yet still support them because, you know, oh, they're on our side. They're leaders of our party. You know, we vote for them anyways. It just doesn't make sense. Whereas Belle and the Beast, they sort of represent a more lighter set, the more joyful, the where, you know, sort of the community aspect, especially when Belle's in the village, the sort of community aspect of, you know, what we are and how well we work together. I think that's just a subtextual thing I saw. I wanted to talk about it for just a moment because it's something, again, I personally saw. and brought a little bit of enjoyment. And I think that's something that this movie, on a very deep, deep, deep subtextual level that not even the Disney creators planned, that can be enjoyed in this film. And I think it's something that can be implied to any society. I'm just using current events in our society to talk about that. At the end of the day, final thing I want to talk about is why this is the greatest movie of all time. You know, when I talk about my list of my top five movies of all time, it's either tied for number one, or I just put it whichever I decided to put in number one. But my two number ones are Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Beauty and the Beast. But I think Beauty and the Beast is the greatest movie of all time. It's a complete story. There are mistakes made, absolutely. It's not perfect because everything about it is perfect, but because it is a complete story. It is this great drama that draws you in emotionally and makes you care about these people. And makes you... I gotta talk about this. Like I said before, I didn't talk about this with the animation. I kind of forgot. But like I said, I went to see the 3D animated, the 3D version of the film, which came out a couple weeks ago. And by the way, the 3D just added great depth to the multiplane of the film, you know, because really that's what it was really used for in this film, which I thought worked really well. It wasn't gimmicky 3D. It used it to add a sense of depth to scenes. It made the animated film feel kind of like a pop-up book, which I found incredible and beautiful and just a beauty to watch. It really added depth and that third dimension, mind you, to the animation. But there were two things that happened that I had never experienced before in a film. One, everybody in the theater, and we had like a half-packed theater. I mean, still scattered around, but pretty much half-packed. But still, everybody was singing the song, and I was worried about me singing the songs and interrupting people, but everybody was singing the songs. I mean, yeah, I was behind these two girls, and you can hear them on the record going, "Tell us all this time, da-da-da-da-da, you know, be our guest," and it's like, it blows me away that we're all singing these songs, and nobody has a problem with it. You know, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, it was a beautiful thing, but the other thing is when the film ended, everybody stood up and gave it a rousing applause. It was absolutely beautiful. And I think that really shows why this movie is the greatest movie of all time. You know, I think that is the separation of really great movies. Is that even, let's see, what has it been? 20 years later. It's been over 20 years. It still gets a standing up applause at the end of the movie. It is that great of a movie. And by the way, the 3D version has, I love the ending credits because they have sort of these line drawings that also pop out with the credits that are absolutely beautiful. But I really do suggest, I don't know if it's still playing, but if it is, and if you can still see it in theaters, I highly suggest going to see the 3D version in theaters. But yeah, it's just one of those films that is perfect. Everything about it is perfect. Not because things are necessarily perfect, but because it is such a complete story. It's so wonderful. At the end of the day, it's sort of like a great roller coaster. As soon as you finish the movie, you want to go right back at the beginning and watch the beginning of the movie. There are very few movies that are on its level, and I think there are none better. So Beauty and the Beast, it's 5 out of 5. It's 10 out of... No, it's not 5. On a scale of 1 to 5, it's a 10. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's 100. On a scale of 100, it's a million. You know, it's everything you want in movie making. It's movie magic at its best. It's perfection. It's my favorite movie of all times, and I absolutely love it. And really, it should be a part of anybody's collection, especially if you're an animation fan. So, that's it for this week's episode of Tom's Prerogative. Guys, let me know what you think. I really do want to know what people think about my review of Beauty and the Beast. If you agree, disagree with anything I said, or anything about the site for that matter. You can do it in several different ways. You can leave comments on the post of this episode at the site, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. You can also leave me email by emailing to absolution132. That's 132 is all a number, so it's a 1, a 3, and a 2. absolution132@yahoo.com. And hopefully soon I have iTunes. So if you're listening to this episode on iTunes, do leave me iTunes reviews. But as of the point of this recording, we're still not on iTunes. Hopefully we'll get it up soon. Remember to check out all my other podcasts that I do on other sites for 132 Productions, which includes the Tokyo SOS Godzilla podcast, which you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, my Comic Book Crazy podcast and Hexcast podcast over at the Comic Book Crazy podcasting site, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. Remember to check out all our friends on the sidebar of the site that you can find, which includes Michael Bailey's Views from the Lone Box and From Crisis to Crisis, Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawl Space, Kyle Young's Kaiju Cast, Steven Slyker's Major Spoilers, Scott Gardner's 22 Freaks, and of course, all our other friends that you can find there on the sidebar of the site. Check them out, support them. They do great podcasts, they do great work. And since I mentioned it all through Disney Month, really check out Doug Walker. You know, you should check out Doug Walker's Nora videos as a nostalgia critic that he does a great job on. He's very funny, but really check out his Disney December group of video podcasts where he goes through basically all, he goes from Snow White all the way up to Winnie the Pooh. And they're like own separate like 2 to 4 minute videos. They're beauty to watch and he does a great job with them. So that's it for this week's show. Next week's episode. Next week's episode might be a surprise for you. I may or may not have a guest. I don't know. I'm still working on that. But please stay tuned for next week's episode. So until then, my Toonami generation, stay golden.
Accursed samurai. Succeeded again in eluding my effort, but I am not worried, for one day you will fail.
By DJ Clark Nova. Don't sleep on it.